This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Omar Abdelhamid, is a Syrian dissident who left his country last year. He says growing up in Syria in the 70s and 80s, it wasn't fears of an Israeli attack that kept him up at night. If there was a boogeyman in his life, it was the dreaded Syrian security apparatus and certain government officials. Abdelhamid's family is famous in Syria. His mother is a movie star. His late father was a director. Abdelhamid studied in the U.S. between 1986 and 94. He's a poet and novelist and writes a blog called Amarji. He's also a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution's Saban Center for Middle East Policy. Omar Abdelhamid, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me read something you recently wrote in talking about conflicts between Israel and Arab countries. You wrote, "I put the greater burden of blame on us, because all of us, both people and ruling elites alike, are always so cavalier in our willingness to confront Israel and the international community and to supply them with all the necessary excuses and justifications for their acts of aggression against us." How does that apply to the current conflict?
Well, the adventures of Hezbollah, basically. Hezbollah, the reason why Hezbollah is acting against Israel and has been sort of attacking Israel for the last 6 years really has nothing to do with Lebanese national interests. It has something to do with Hezbollah's desire not to disarm and to hedge its bets vis-a-vis other communities in Lebanon by showing that it doesn't only represent a demographic power but also a military power. There is also its Islamic predilection. There is an inability, basically, to accept Israel's right to exist. And also there is Hezbollah's role as a proxy for Syria's the Syrian regime interests and the Iranian mullah's interests, which is to dissuade public attention from their own internal problems and to create pressure on Israel for the return of the Golan Heights as far as Syria is concerned. And the reality is our main struggle is not simply to only get back the occupied land, but it's also to develop our countries and our economies. We are experiencing a lot of problems, and our main problems really are developmental issues. And we have been spending on the military and on armament for the last 30 to 50 years without really spending enough monies on education, on healthcare, on infrastructure.
Now, I know that you oppose the government of Bashar Assad, and you oppose the government of his father, Hafez al-Assad. But do you support the Bush administration's interest in regime change in Syria? And, you know, who knows what, if anything, the Bush administration would do to move toward that goal. But do you think that's a wise goal for the Bush administration to have?
Well, to be honest with you, this is exactly where I am, find myself always second-guessing myself. On the one hand, I don't want to see an Iraqi scenario in Syria. On the other hand, I cannot stomach the idea that an administration in the United States, whether it's the Bush administration or any upcoming administration, should sit down with the Bashar and have talks with him to normalize the relationship between the two countries at the cost of internal reforms. We have been through that path before. I mean, this has been the realpolitik policy that has been followed over and over again, and it always came down at the expense of internal freedoms. And this is not going to allow our societies to develop. The more we deal with the corrupt elites, the more we are going to have societies that are breaking up and going in a more radical direction. What I'm afraid of is that we are going to have a series of failed states in the region under the rule of these corrupt regimes because they are siphoning off all the fortunes, all the wealth in the country. They are not addressing in any serious manner the developmental needs of the country, and we are reaching in several of the countries in the Middle East, Syria included, a level where any more pressures, the entire state could collapse. So in a sense, I support regime change by internal means, simply because the rule of the Assads have brought us disasters and will continue to bring us disasters. But at the same time, I want America to back us only as far as putting pressures and isolating the Syrian regime. I don't want to see military action because this will also create a lot of havoc in the country and may not have may not even help our cause, because by that time you will be so entangled in American policies for the region and for the country, and that you will not be able to shake free from that. So it's a mixture. A mixed approach, therefore. I just want the regime to be isolated, and I want us to then do the job of achieving regime change by hopefully orchestrating some kind of a velvet revolution.
When you were growing up in Syria, what were you taught about Israel in your school, by your parents, by your friends?
Basically, it's it shouldn't be surprising here that we're taught to hate Israel, both as a Zionist entity, as a Jewish entity, and we studied history from our own perspective, which blames Israel for almost everything basically wrong in our societies today, and the Zionist conspiracy and imperialism and so on. So I had a very unflattering views of Israel and the Israelis. And it's only when I came to the United States to study at the University of Wisconsin that I had a different version of history, and that I have, in fact, even had some contacts with Israelis. And increasingly in the early 90s, when we had the Madrid conference and then the whole peace process was started, the contacts began to be more friendly with Israeli students. Now we can talk actually about the possibilities of peace, and I think we had some hope basically that we can really end this in the 1990s, and we can start sort of a new chapter. And there is enough of blame to go around why this did not happen. You can blame the Israelis for dragging their feet. You can blame the Syrians, and I do a lot for also dragging their feet. I don't want to spend my time criticizing Israel and the United States and imperialism and Zionism and what have you, because there are enough critics out there of Israeli policies. In fact, all of our criticism is aimed at Israeli policies, but we don't have enough criticism of our own policies in the Arab-Israeli conflict or in our internal policies. So I spend most of my time doing that, which is why I sound sometimes too radical or unbalanced. But the reality is I don't have to repeat what other people are saying. We know where Israel is wrong. It's occupying our land. We understand how we got to this state of affairs. But what have we done right in order to get back our lands? The reality is our tactics have always been the wrong tactics.
What were you taught about the United States when you were growing up?
It's an imperialist nation. We are a socialist nation. So you can imagine the kind of rhetoric we've had. It's the usual Soviet-style rhetoric vis-a-vis American imperialism and so on. So, but however, when it comes to America, the interesting thing is, of course, is American culture. So people cannot simply overlook American culture or American products. So, and whenever a brand has is really made in the USA or has an American feel to it, the people will simply prefer it over anything else. And American movies were always popular, and American TV series were always popular. For a while, the government tried to introduce Russian series no one wanted to watch. So everything you can imagine in the 70s and 80s that you've been watching in the States, you've been watching, from the Mod Squad to Hawaii 5-0 to Star Trek to whatever, we've seen them all.
It sometimes seems like it would be almost surreal to be watching shows like that while you're living in, you know, virtually a dictatorship.
It is surreal. It is definitely surreal. But this is something that we have lived for. I mean, that's why many people say that we are so restricted and whatever. But the reality is we do have a cosmopolitan view that's much richer than people imagine. I mean, we've been exposed to American TV shows, French TV shows, Russian TV shows, even sometimes Chinese. And And all of these have taken part in our upbringing. A lot of my friends tell me that, you know, you're not true to who you are because you're so westernized and so on. And I look at them and tell them, what do you mean? I grew up listening to rock and roll as much as I grew up listening to Arab pop songs, and I grew up watching American movies. I'm true to who I am. I am a cosmopolitan person. I'm a cosmopolitan man, and this is my real heritage.
My guest is Syrian dissident Ammar Abdelhamid. He's now affiliated with the Brookings Institution. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ammar Abdelhamid, and he's a Syrian dissident now living in the United States, where he's a non-resident fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Now, you grew up in a very well-known and special family. Your mother is a famous Syrian actress, and your father was a well-known film director. So did that give your family special privileges within Syrian society, or did it make your family more suspect by the government?
Actually, it gave us a special privilege, I have to admit. I have always been considered to be part of the very elite that I'm attacking right now. And I went to the same schools that our president, Bashar al-Assad, went to. We were not really colleagues or classmates. I've always hated his guts from way back then. And at the same time, one of the reasons why, when calling the president on a variety of interviews when I was in Syria up until recently, calling him Alfredo Corleone, the idiot mafioso and whatever, instead of actually getting shot or getting imprisoned, at least I simply got a call that it's about and for an interview. And in that interview, I was told by the president's brother-in-law and the head of the military security apparatus that probably it's better to leave the country at this stage. So I was given away.
Let me stop you a second. So when you made a comparison between the current president of Syria, Bashar Assad, who succeeded his father, Hafez al-Assad as president, you were interrogated for that? And why don't you tell us what the analogy was that you made between the current president of Syria, Bashar Assad, and Fredo Corleone from the Godfather movie. What did you say?
Well, basically, it's ever since he came to power, Bashar struck me as being weak and dumb. And I've always known him in school, and I've never really had a high opinion of him. So I was being interviewed because I also had this as a dissident who is very vocal, and as a person who is in charge of an organization, an NGO that works on relationship between minorities and majorities. I had a lot of interviews, and I was given a lot of interviews. And in a few of them, I compared the president to Fredo Corleone, the weaker, dumber brother, basically, in the Corleone family in the Godfather movie. So many people were always making comparison, well, perhaps Bashar would be Michael Corleone, and he will legitimize the family business. And I told him, no, he's a Fredo Corleone. He's a weaker idiot brother who had no interest, in fact, in legitimizing the family business, and who was always manipulated by others to do their bidding. And to me, therefore, he was really not convincing as a leader. And having said that, yes, I got a call finally for an interrogation by the president's brother-in-law and the head of the military security apparatus, and one of the chief suspects also in the Hariri assassination. You know, I was told off about this interview and about my activities and my statements. And after we had it out for a while, I was asked to actually leave the country. And had it not been for my background, and had my mom not been so famous and all, and had I not had some contacts also with such institutions as Brookings and outside, I would never have had the opportunity to leave. I would have been shot or put in prison or made to disappear, as some of my colleagues were. So indeed, I was lucky to come from a certain background, and I feel guilty about it a lot of times, but it's also the reality that has saved my life.
Is your mother still in Syria?
Yes, she is.
And do you worry that she might be punished for your outspokenness, even though you're living in the United States now?
She is too famous, I think, for her to be hassled in any manner.
Now, you are a dissident. You are a Syrian dissident. You oppose the government, and you also oppose Islamic radicalism. At the same time, earlier in your life, when you were in college, you had become a fundamentalist Muslim, and from what I've read, even considered going to Afghanistan in the late 80s to fight against the Soviets. How did you become a radical Muslim?
Well, this is one of those things that I've never really understood myself completely. It seems, however, the reasons were far more psychological than ideological. I was a very introverted child, and had my mom's fame and my parents' fame, and being under the spotlight all the time, sort of, you can say, was not very comfortable thing for me. It brought the envy and jealousy of my peers in school, and I've really never really was comfortable with it. So I guess what happened is, at one point, religion empowered me. Instead of saying I'm shy, I can always say I'm religious. You know, I'm not introverted. I'm just simply not interested in going out and drinking and following girls. I wanted to, but I was simply too shy and inadequate. So I covered my teenage inadequacies and my youthful inadequacies with a layer of religiosity. And at the same time, religion really managed to bring me out of my shell, because part of the instruction is to actually go to mosques and to pray and to meet with people and to be active. So Islamic fundamentalism actually slowly made me break my shyness, made me become more social, stand up on my own two feet, and interact with people with much more confidence. But the greater the confidence I've gained because of these Islamic activities, the more also I questioned the nature of the ideology itself, because I was never really a person who was comfortable following other people's dictates. I've always had a free mind. This is the heritage that I've had from my family. They've always encouraged me to form my own conclusions and opinions. So as I was doing that and growing in confidence, I was also questioning the very basis of the ideology I have adopted. Eventually, this led me out.
Now, I've read also that the fatwa against Salman Rushdie also made you question the religion that you had become part of, or the radicalism of the religion you'd become part of.
Indeed. At one point, as I was going through this period of questioning the ideology, the Salman Rushdie affair also broke out. And even though I was willing to condemn the book without having read only excerpts of it that were sent to us by some Islamic groups in London, I still could not stomach the death sentence. I can see this as something that is definitely unacceptable. And at that time, I was interviewed by the Los Angeles Times because I was working as an imam in a mosque. And I condemned the book, but I also condemned the fatwa, which created a lot of problems for me with the Iranian community that and the Shia community that also use the mosque to pray. After a while, I realized, frankly, that I cannot belong to that, and I cannot keep on doing what I'm doing, being an imam and preaching, whatever. It's something that I'm not interested in anyway, and that my views were really radically different from those of the congregation. So I left the mosque and read more about the country I'm staying in, about the United States, and finally decided to go back to college and study history. I was studying astronomy at one point, but I realized really I need to go back to Earth and root myself more in human values.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you've written a couple of novels. One of them,
yes.
One of them is titled Menstruation, a very provocative title, particularly in an Islamic country. Another had an even more provocative title, The Whore with the Trillion Vulvas.
Yes.
Tell me something about these novels and why you wrote books with such, like, truly intentionally provocative titles.
The idea was to try to, for the first novel, Menstruation, was to deal with the concept of sexuality in our societies. Many people think that we are very conservative. They don't realize that we are only conservative on the surface, but underneath the surface, we can be very adventurous. The idea of writing something with this title, Menstruation, goes back to when I was a fundamentalist. In a mosque, we were, in fact, a group of young men, and we were studying Sharia. And part of the Sharia has to do with hygiene and feminine hygiene, and as such, the menstrual cycle, because women during the cycle are not considered to be pure. So there are certain things and that they should not do, and certain things that they could do, and so on. So, and I was looking around, and we were all, young men, and the teacher was, of course, male. And I thought, why should we classify in the final analysis women according to liquid oozing out of their bodies? I mean, it's ridiculous. So eventually, the idea of writing something about that was always in my mind. And when I finally became, I don't know, a heretic, I wrote about it in a heretical manner.
My guest is Syrian dissident Ammar Abdulhamid. He's now affiliated with the Brookings Institution. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ammar Abdulhamid. He's a Syrian dissident who left his country last year and now lives in the U.S. He's a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution's Saban Center for Middle East Policy. In an article in the New York Times Magazine in 2005 that was largely devoted to you, the writer said, Islamists have pushed liberals to the sidelines. As a result, the Arab world's democracy activists and intellectuals don't enjoy the same advantages their Central and Eastern European counterparts did back in the 80s. Do you agree with him that Arab dissidents now and liberals now in the Arab world don't have that kind of central role and visibility that the dissidents did in Eastern Europe in the Soviet era?
Yes, I agree. The liberals really are fighting an uphill battle in order to be heard by the streets and in order to get more credibility by the street. The reality is regimes have been oppressing the liberals and the secular forces in the country and across the region much more vehemently than the Islamists. You know, with the Islamists, they followed a more sort of diverse approach. They oppressed some, but they also tolerated and even encouraged others. With the dissidents, it was across the liberal dissidents, it was across the board attempt at silencing every independent voice out there. For this reason, we really don't have much of a grassroots support. Some of us do, and those who do are the older generation who had already been established before regimes had this chance to oppress them, and they had a resonance in people's mind and imagination that the regimes could not wipe out. But the new voices, and perhaps I'm one of the new voices, really we're having a hard time being heard back home. Some of us complicated the matter by the fact that they use other languages like English and French to express themselves, and I use English mostly. So that also created a sort of a language cutoff. But we feel much more comfortable, frankly, in these other languages because they're more dynamic. Arabic have become too stultified anyway. So we have become too alienated from our own culture and society also for our own good. We have somehow to go back and try to reestablish this connection with the heritage and see if we can indeed regain our relevance on the street.
There was a group of dissidents who were arrested just a couple of months ago in Syria for signing what's called the Beirut-Damascus Declaration of May 12th, and it called for the normalization of relations between Syria and Lebanon and for a properly demarcated border and the exchange of ambassadors, while also opposing United States and Israeli influence in the region. I'm wondering if any of those dissidents who signed this declaration and were arrested are friends of yours.
Yes, all of them. All of them are friends of mine. And it's really a pity because I left just a few months before this whole thing happened. And had I been there, I probably would have been included. And in fact, these people are not simply friends, but they are, many of them are older, so they are even mentors. And it's really a blow to the entire movement of dissidents and opposition to Syria that now our leaders are behind bars. But there are still enough of us outside also. And frankly, despite all this attempt at crackdown, there are a lot of people still writing and speaking from inside Syria to actually show that we simply are not willing to back down at this stage. We have staked a new ground, and we realize what's at stake here. It's really the future of the entire country, so we have no choice but to persevere in the course that we have chosen, despite the fact that we know that there are going to be a lot of sacrifices ahead of us. And so far, frankly, the regime, even though it cracked down on certain figures, it has not really been able to muster enough popular approval to crack down on all descent. So that's also a sign that we have created some room to maneuver.
Well, one more question. What is it like for you sitting safely in your new home in the United States when you watch the fighting that's going on now in the Middle East?
It's surreal and depressing. Feelings of guilt are always there. Feeling of helplessness are always there. Feeling of deja vu is really dominates the scene also, as far as I'm concerned, because this is exactly the kind of mayhem I was saying will happen sooner or later. Even though I didn't really necessarily expect Israel to be involved so strongly, I thought that we are going to end up killing each other. So Israel might just facilitate that and be a catalyst in this matter. We are worried constantly. You know, the kids and I, my wife, are definitely depressed, and we are developing also physical symptoms. We are seeing doctors left and right for a variety of symptoms that no one can explain, except to say, oh yes, when they hear about our background and whatever, oh yes, definitely it's depression, it's whatever. So the reality is, it's very difficult for us. I mean, being safe and at the same time being out, but yet we are still in, and we have to watch all this, and we can't be detached, really.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Ammar Abdelhamid is a Syrian dissident who is now a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution's Saban Center for Middle East Policy.